Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Our mission here is, well, it's simple. You bring us the sources, and we pull out the essential knowledge so you don't have to.
And today we are continuing a deep dive requested by one of you. We're moving through the Book of Mormon section of the CES letter, specifically looking at the source material for questions 6 through 11.
Right, and before we jump into the evidence, we really need to anchor this whole conversation in one core idea. Informed consent.
Exactly. It's not about belief, it's about transparency. The author of the source, Jeremy Reynolds, puts it perfectly. He says members and investigators deserve to have all the facts and information on the table to be able to make a fully informed and balanced decision.
And we should probably mention the common attacks on the author. You know, the claims that he wasn't sincere or he just crowdsourced this from Reddit.
We should, because the sources are clear that those are just ad hominem attacks. They don't matter.
They don't. The sincerity of the person asking the questions has nothing to do with whether the questions themselves are valid. We're focused on the substance.
Okay, with that foundation, let's get straight into it. Section 1, the historical claims, starting with question 6, the archaeology problem.
And the claim here is, I mean, it's a huge one. The CES letter states there is absolutely no archaeological evidence to directly support the Book of Mormon.
No. And we're talking about, supposedly, civilizations of millions of people. So that's a staggering claim. Of course, there are counterclaims. Groups like Scripture Central have a few examples they always point to.
And we need to look at those. Our sources analyze about 5 of them. So where should we start?
Let's start with the foundational artifact itself. The metal plates.
Okay.
The critique here is really twofold. It's about the physical reality of them. The size, and especially the density, you'd need to hold that much text.
Especially in something called Reformed Egyptian.
Exactly, a script that doesn't exist anywhere else. But even if you grant that, the sheer volume of text just wouldn't fit on plates of the size and weight that Joseph Smith described.
And then there's the whole secrecy part of it. Joseph hiding them, the witnesses seeing them with their spiritual eyes.
Right, that phrase, spiritual eyes, really raises fundamental questions about their actual physical reality.
So the core artifact is shaky from the start. What's next on the apologist's list? The altar at Nahom.
Yes, and this is a classic case of what some academics call parallel mania. You have an altar in Yemen with 3 letters, NHM.
Right, because ancient Semitic languages didn't write vowels.
Precisely. So apologists say, well, this could be Nahom, but it's just a possibility. It's a coincidence. Treating 3 letters as definitive proof is just, well, it's confirmation bias.
You're finding what you want to find. Okay, what about cement in Mesoamerica?
Well, the cement is real, but this evidence actually works against the traditional narrative. For over a century, the church taught that everything happened in North America, around New York.
So pointing to evidence in Mesoamerica is already a huge contradiction of what early leaders taught.
It's a major goalpost shift. And the last two, the seal of Neuch and the barley, are similar stretches. The seal's name is a linguistic stretch, and the barley they found was a tiny, wild version, not the abundance described in the book.
It seems like all these counterclaims are pretty weak when you dig into them. And this brings us to a really key analytical idea you mentioned, the one anachronism rule.
The rule is very simple, and it applies to any historical document. It only takes one clear mistake, one anachronism, to prove a text isn't what it claims to be.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. If you found a photo, supposedly of Abraham Lincoln, and he was taking a selfie with an iPhone, it wouldn't matter if his suit was perfect and the background was perfect.
The iPhone blows the whole thing up.
The iPhone proves it's not authentic. The Book of Mormon has a whole catalog of these anachronisms, steel, chariots, horses, that these very weak counterexamples just can't overcome.
And that archaeological silence leads us right into the next problem, the Qumorah controversy. Because early church leaders were very, very specific about where that hill was.
Oh, absolutely specific. The source quotes Joseph Fielding Smith confirming it's in Western New York. Brigham Young, Oliver Cowdery, they all said it was there. Fact. No ambiguity.
But then the science came in. BYU's own archaeologist, John Clark, studied that exact hill. And what did he find?
His conclusion was damning. He said, archaeologically speaking, it is a clean hill. No artifacts, no walls, no trenches, no arrowheads.
A clean hill, after a supposed final battle involving hundreds of thousands of people.
Exactly. So he concluded, we must look elsewhere for that hill. And this forced the institution into, you know, a really tough spot.
This is that goalpost shift you mentioned.
It's a massive one. They had to invent a second Qumorah down in Mesoamerica, directly contradicting Joseph Smith and the early prophets. And that is deeply, deeply concerning.
It's also had real-world consequences for people's faith. You mentioned Thomas Stewart Ferguson.
A tragic story. A devout Mormon lawyer becomes an archaeologist, spends his life and his fortune digging in Mesoamerica for Book of Mormon cities.
And he found...
He found nothing. And the sources are clear that lack of evidence is what ultimately caused him to lose his faith.
Okay, let's touch quickly on question 7, the geography parallels. This is the idea that Book of Mormon names like Lehi or Oneida sound a lot like place names in Joseph Smith's neighborhood.
It's contextually interesting. It helps frame the book as a product of its environment.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to be fair here.
Right, because couldn't an apologist just say this is the same parallel mania you were just criticizing with the Nahum altar?
That's a fair challenge. And it's why, you know, of all the arguments in the CES letter, this one's probably the weakest. It adds color, but it's not definitive proof like the archaeological silence is.
Okay, so the physical setting, the archaeology, the geography, it's all on very shaky ground. That forces us to look at the literary setting. Let's move to section 2, the literary and cultural parallels.
Right. What was in the, let's call it the cultural soup that Joseph Smith was swimming in? We start with question 8 and a book called View of the Hebrews.
Published in 1823, so just a few years before the Book of Mormon. And the connection is pretty direct, right?
Very direct. It was written by Ethan Smith in Vermont, and Oliver Cowdery Joseph's main scribe was a member of his congregation. The idea that this book was around is highly plausible.
And the parallels were so strong that they worried people high up in the church.
They worried B.H. Roberts, who was a general authority and the church historian. He called the similarities a serious menace to the official origin story of the Book of Mormon.
A serious menace?
Yeah.
What exactly were the parallels that troubled him so much?
It was the entire meta-narrative. View of the Hebrews lays out the same core story. Israelite origins for Native Americans, the destruction of Jerusalem, a good tribe versus a bad tribe.
Light skin versus dark skin.
Exactly. The gathering of Israel, extensive use of Isaiah. It's the whole framework.
But to be clear, the argument isn't plagiarism. That's a straw man apologists use. It's about influence. This was the popular mound builder myth of the day.
Precisely. This idea of a lost, advanced white race being wiped out by a savage, darker race was the common explanation for the mounds in the Ohio Valley. Joseph didn't invent this story. He just gave it names and details.
Which carries us to the next sources, the late war and the first book of Napoleon. These deal with the actual writing style.
Right. The late war was a textbook from 1819 about the war of 1812, and it was written in that old King James style English.
And it has that one phrase that just jumps out at you, and it came to pass.
Over and over, at least 84 times in that textbook.
Compared to what, something like 1400 times in the Book of Mormon?
About 1430, yes. It just shows that this style wasn't some ancient Hebraic form of writing. It was a 19th century American literary trend.
And the first Book of Napoleon had similar phrases like condemn not the writing, things that show up in the Book of Mormon.
When you put these sources together, view of the Hebrews for the story, late war for the style, it makes the idea of a farm boy writing the book. Well, it becomes far less incredible. It helps explain the birth of the Book of Mormon.
It provides the toolkit. Okay, let's pivot to what might be the most challenging section for believers. Section 3, the theological inconsistencies. This is all about question 11.
And this is powerful because it's based on changes made to the book after it was published. The main issue is the evolving Godhead.
The 1830 edition of the Book of Mormon taught a pretty standard Trinitarian view of God, right?
Yes, a modalist or Trinitarian view. Father, Son, and Holy Ghost are one being, which, importantly, matched the common Protestant theology of Joseph's day. It was his early theology.
But his theology changed over time.
It evolved dramatically. He later taught that God and Jesus are separate beings, that God was once a man, a completely different model.
And the Book of Mormon text was changed to match.
Over 100,000 changes were made. And many of the most significant ones were to update the theology, to make God and Jesus separate beings where the original text said they were one.
This is a huge problem for a supposedly ancient, perfectly translated text.
It's the smoking gun. Because the first vision story also changed in the exact same way. The 1832 version says only the Lord appeared. The 1838 official version says God the Father and Jesus Christ appeared as two separate beings.
So the book and the foundational vision evolved together.
Yeah.
Alongside Joseph's own understanding.
In lockstep. And the church leadership knew how bad this looked. The sources confirmed that Joseph Fielding Smith found that 1832 first vision account was so troubled by it, he physically ripped it out of the journal and hid it for decades.
You hid it. That's an active suppression of history.
It shows they knew this evolution was a potential faith killer, which brings up this incredible irony.
With Brad Wilcox, the apologist.
Yeah. Wilcox argues that if Joseph were lying, he would have just said God and Jesus were one, because that was the common, safe view.
But he did say that.
He did. In his earliest account, he originally conformed to the normal theology and only changed it later. The evidence shows composition, not translation.
Which brings us to the timeline. Apologists love to say the translation only took 65 to 75 days, as if that's proof of a miracle.
But the sources show the real, extended timeline. Joseph had years, from about 1818 to 1829, to think about these ideas, to hear sermons, to absorb the mound builder myths.
And there were long gaps in the process.
Huge gaps. After he lost the 116 pages, there was a break of about 9 months. That's a lot of time for, you know, reflection or trying to come up with more story.
It points to a process of writing and composing, not just reading off a stone.
Absolutely. And the part we read is the beginning of the book, First Nephi, was actually translated last. He went back and wrote the beginning at the end. That's what an author does, not a translator of a finished ancient record.
So if we pull this all together, the archaeology, the geography, the literary parallels, the evolving theology, what's the final assessment of these questions from the CES letter?
I'd say the critique is incredibly strong. The sources consistently show the Book of Mormon is a document that perfectly reflects the historical, literary, and theological world of 19th century America. It's roughly, I'd say, 10 out of 11 hits for the CES letter's core arguments.
The big takeaway, really, is that the evidence overwhelmingly points to it being a 19th century creation, born from that cultural soup we talked about.
And the church itself seems to be tacitly admitting this. There's been a very quiet but significant shift recently. In their Gospel Topics essays, they're starting to call the Book of Mormon a revelation, not a translation.
Which is a huge change.
It's a tacit admission that defending it as a literal historical record translated from gold plates has become indefensible.
That reframing is a profound response to the evidence. Okay, so here's a final thought for you to take with you, building on everything we've covered. If early prophets and leaders were demonstrably wrong about something as foundational and physical as the location of the Hill Cumorah, how does that affect your reliance on current leaders for essential truth claims today?
A critical question. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.
We hope you'll continue exploring with us. Next time, we'll dig into the source material and the translation process itself, specifically the use of the seer stone and the hat. Until then, stay curious.